Dear friends, in this blessed weekly study of Bhagavad Gita, the great scripture of mankind, we have finished studying the first 12 chapters and are going to embark on the 13th chapter from today. Before we start that, let us take a brief review of what we have studied till now. Bhagavad Gita, as you know, begins with the despondent Arjuna, very despondent because of the confusion as to what is real and what is not real, what is I should be doing, what I should not be doing. The personality was just caught in two different pulls in life, and one gets into confusion because of that. It is quite obvious even in the ordinary matters when we have this choice. It is not really a choice. It is our path gets split into two. There is a fork ahead. Now, which side to go? Whether to take this or that, if we do not have a clear direction, then there is confusion, and we have to take some course. We cannot remain stranded there. All the cars behind us will start honking. So therefore, we cannot just stay put there. We have to go here or there. It is not that we can be just there thinking for too long a time. It is a matter that is needed to be urgently resolved. And therefore, Arjuna feels this tremendous pain as to what should I be doing. On one side, there is the an understanding that I must perform my duty no matter what. My duty tells me to fight this war. In fact, it was I who was very enthusiastic in declaring this war. I want to wreak revenge on these my evil cousins who have done us a very bad deal, and therefore I need to take this step of war. On the other hand, he is being also pulled by the considerations of losing his kith and kin and maybe his own life in this war, because war means death. War means you will be seeing the death of so many. And when this war on one side are all your known friends, relatives, some of them whom you are acquainted since early childhood, those who have taught you, your teachers, your elderly all relations, uncles and so forth, your grandfather who loved you so much, cared for you, done so many things for you. And on the that both sides, such people were there. So how the prospect of getting all of them killed was not very welcome either. So a person, what should that person do at this juncture of life? And there, caught in this dilemma, he kind of decides, he tells Sri Krishna very firmly in a way that I am not going to fight you all, and gives a long list of all the ills that would come because of the war. But in the mind he was not quite comfortable even doing that, because then he was aware that he is not performing his duty, he was not doing what was right for him to do, and so he was suffering because of that, and then requests Krishna to remove this suffering of his. His suffering was tremendous, described in these two verses of Bhagavad Gita which come about in the beginning of the second chapter, that this terrible suffering is taking out all the vitality of my life. My life, as it were, is being sucked out of me. I am suffering because of that, and I know for sure that even if I get the kingdom of all three worlds, this suffering is not going to go away. Arjuna was very clear about that, that even if I get the kingdom of all three worlds, I am not going to get rid of this suffering. Therefore, you now, why you? Because you have the clarity of understanding. Sri Krishna was not feeling any confusion. He was very clear because of the knowledge. When one has the knowledge, then the mind becomes clear of all these emotional or temporary driftings in life. And so he sees in Krishna that clarity. And so he takes up Krishna as his spiritual teacher, the guru. The requirement one feels in life, somebody who can pull me out of this mire. I am stuck in this. And so I take refuge in you, he says to Krishna, that it is very difficult for a person to look upon his friend as his spiritual teacher. Not an easy thing. Because friend, we have another relation, you know. Hey, my chum, I knew him for last 30 years or 25 years, and we played together. He doesn't know much. It is him. He's a good fellow, but that's about it. We don't look upon our friend as our guide and philosopher, although this phrase is quite popular, friend, philosopher and guide. It is not easy to look upon friend. Yes, the other way it is okay. If somebody is your guide, teacher, you can establish a relationship later. It becomes very friendly to you. That is a different matter. But to make a friend our teacher, our guru, is not that easy. But Arjuna has just seen that Sri Krishna's two verses, just a very short advice, had illumined him, brought some sense in him, that not fighting the war is not a solution as such. And therefore he is seeking the advice of Krishna, that, well, please, I take refuge in you, shishya steham, I am your disciple. The words are so clear. Arjuna's words at that juncture, shishya steham, I am your disciple, shadhimam, please lift me out of this terrible situation that I have got myself in, tvam prapannam. And how am I? Well, I am surrendering myself to you. I am your disciple, I am surrendering to you. That is the attitude, right attitude of the disciple. But that attitude, although one feels emotionally, it doesn't last too long. In Arjuna's case also, immediately he said, please take me out of this mire, but I am not going to fight war. Means it is like that famous saying of some president of United States, that somebody asked him that what color should be put on this building, and he said, I don't mind any color you put as long as it is black. So that means really actually no choice has been given there. So Arjuna is telling Krishna that yes, na yotseti govindam uktva tushni babhuva, that after saying all this, he says, but I am not going to fight, that's for sure. Then why you are asking my advice? We want to do what we want to do. And yet we feel that, yes, this teacher should give me all the necessary guidance. What is the use if we are going to stick to our guns anyway? So, therefore, this attitude is described, that a person wants to get the advice, wants to the teacher to take him or her out of this mire, but yet, I am not going to do this. Well, if you should be ready to do that, if that is going to be the uplifting element for you, if that is the element that is going to rescue you, then you should do that. So, it is for Sri Krishna now to bring illumination. And thus, because of that illumination now, that Arjuna's understanding that I am not going to fight, or these are all my kith and kin, and I am responsible for their protection or for their killing, all that misunderstanding starts going, and there Sri Krishna begins with that showing the discernment, that be clear what is the function of our intellect to show clearly what is real and what is unreal. And Bhagavad Gita gives that criterion to separate that, what is real and what is unreal. It is very intriguing. Many times this question gets asked, and we had this discussion even before today many times in Bhagavad Gita classes, as to how to decide what is real and what is unreal. And the criterion given in Vedanta is whatever is changing, that is unreal. Whatever is unchanging, that is real. And thus we have now a standard by which to decide what is real and what is unreal. And then you see that what changes, the body keeps on changing. We all experience that the body keeps on continuously changing. In fact, the name of all these changes is what is body. And so, the body is not real, and body is therefore not the self. So also, the mind keeps on changing. That too is not self. And then what is self? We always feel an unchanging basis of that. That when we learn to transcend, that is a training that is to be given to the mind, that how to transcend itself. One has to learn how to transcend the changes so that we can see, we can have a feel of the unchanging. That look a bit penetratively and we will be able to see our true nature that does not change. We see that in spite of being in continuous changes, even the very fact that continuous change refers to continuity of something. Even though there is a flux of matter all around, the matter and mind both, yet we have something that is unchanging, that understanding remains always. Without that, even the change cannot be perceived. To perceive the change too, we need to take recourse to something that is unchanging. We have that discussion many times in study of Bhagavad Gita. And then in the second chapter itself, Arjuna is told that, look, this theoretical understanding can be and should be, in fact must be, converted into practical experience. And that is what is called, in one word, yoga. Yoga is conversion of the intellectual understanding into a tangible, practical, living experience. It becomes an experience. You see some country in map, and then that is one understanding. But then you go to that country, live there, that is a tangible experience. So seeing a country in map, one thing, and living there is another thing. Just reading a book on swimming, one thing, and then jumping in water and getting expertise in swimming is quite another thing. So, knowing these things intellectually is only a small one aspect of getting knowledge. The knowledge that is only in intellect, it is good to have it in intellect than not having it anywhere. But it is good as only a first step. Then the next steps have to follow. It is good, you know, that when you want to, say, take a flight to India, then you have to go to airport. That is the first step. You have to take that step to go to airport. But then you have to take the next step. You cannot be staying at airport all the time. So, and that was not the idea that you came to airport for. So, getting an intellectual understanding of what is Vedanta, it is not for becoming just a dry philosopher or for getting some academic qualifications that one reads these things. And this is a scripture, friends. Bhagavad Gita is not meant for just being able to write a book on Bhagavad Gita and get accolades from scholars. No, that is not the purpose for which Bhagavad Gita was written. It is to get that illumination in our awareness, and then our life will change accordingly. So, that being the purpose, Krishna tells Arjuna that one has to gradually learn to put this in practice. Your understanding is one thing. Now, it takes long time to get it processed. It is not that immediately you will be able to get it into experience. Some will be able to. If one is of that high spiritual level, then just one word of scripture is enough for that person. It is said that a great sage like Shukadeva, was just given a sentence was enough for him, that thou art that. And that was enough. Yes, I am Brahman. I am beyond this changing body and mind. That one sentence was enough for him. Sri Ramakrishna was told by his teacher to concentrate on that all-pervading reality. And that one moment was enough for him to get into that state of samadhi, the supreme realization of that state. Not for everyone. We have to go take baby steps to that. And how these baby steps begin? He first told Arjuna, there is no need for despair. Start walking. The path may be long, but just saying that it is long, doesn't make it shorter anyway. If you start walking, then it starts becoming shorter and shorter. It is, you have to begin, and then you see that it is becoming shorter. Gradually, you get there. But if you just sit where you are and say, the path is so long, keep on weeping, no, that is not going to shorten the path for you. So therefore, it is a very important message for us that don't keep on crying over, I am a bad person, I am a sinner, I did so many bad things in life. Or don't keep on crying. You are crying that I did many bad things earlier, and doesn't change the matters. Be strong. That is very important. Okay, take stand on the intrinsic purity, intrinsic divinity. That is most important. I am divine. Maybe I forgot that divinity, but doesn't mean that I have to now live only in that state of being, that forgetting that divinity. When I remember I am that, that's all. So, we have to take stand on this intrinsic divinity. Okay, I might have committed a few mistakes, but let me learn. Let me go ahead. Let us take that very positive attitude in life. It is very important to get that mode of thinking that yes, I am going to change my life, put it on the right track. It is a great message you get in Swami Vivekananda's teachings that strength is religion, strength is life. Weakness is what produces all sins. The sins come because of the weakness. We commit sins. Why? Because we are weak. We have no strength to resist temptations. And that makes us commit sins. So, don't keep on weeping. Don't become weaker than what you already are. Think of strength, and strength must come. Because it is already in us. That is a very important teaching that we all have to look at, that intrinsic nature of all strength. You don't need to look to some God sitting somewhere and keep on praying, oh, give me strength. All those gods, they are in you. Atmastham. A very commonly occurring word in Bhagavad Gita as well as in all the Vedanta scriptures like Upanishads and the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, that Atmastham, that you have that intrinsically in you. It is inherent in you. So, therefore, Just bring it out. Just take it out. You don't have to go anywhere. You are shivering in cold all the time. Well, there is a nice woolen coat right in your closet. Don't have to go anywhere. Just open and take it out. That is what we need to do. We have it already, all strength with us. And so, just basing on that, standing on that very rock solid foundation of independence, not that something that is dependent on somebody else, and if I get it only if somebody else is going to give me, then it all depends on that fellow. But if it is something that is already with me, then the matter is different. It is just for me to take it. So, friends, we have that already with us. So let us not behave like weaklings. Let us call forth the inner strength. So that is the message. Start practicing. And the idea was given. How to do it? Well, do everything with this attitude. And the great message was given, those four aspects of what is called karma yoga, the yoga of action. Turn your actions to make them the instrument of your liberation rather than the cause of your bondage. We have the instrument, but we don't know how to use it. And therefore, instead of becoming useful, it becomes useless. Not only useless, it becomes detrimental for our progress. And one of those is, those instruments, very potent, is the actions that we do. Every action, if done in the wrong way, binds us. Every action does in the right way and goes to liberate us. So learning the secret of activity, that is karma yoga, and the four aspects of it, remember firstly, karmanyeva adhikaraste. Your field or your authority is only in doing your duty. You should do your duty, your work. And ma phaleshu kadachana. You do not have any right over the results of that action. The results are determined by so many factors. Don't get attached to the results. Do your work. Keep on doing it without craving for the results for yourself. It is a bit difficult to understand that how is it possible. It is possible, friends, to keep on doing one's works without thinking about what will that bring to me. Forget about that. And then you will slowly find that it becomes a liberating force. Your actions become then the actions of the master rather than the actions of a slave. So, gradually you see that it starts transforming the life. It is something that so many people have tried, experimented, and got very tangible results from that in life, that yes, the life starts going in the right direction. So therefore, this is the secret. The third part is, of course, that don't generate the new bondage through the actions. Ma karma phala heturbhu. That do not beget new bondage from the actions that you do by getting attached to it. And that is something that one must be wary of. This is another way of saying the first part, that yes, don't be carried away by what those actions will bring a reward or a punishment for you. Keep on doing your duty. Otherwise, what happens is those actions, you are looking for those results of those actions, will bring bondage to you, because that is how you get bound. It is the craving for getting something out of it for us that is the cause of bondage. It is therefore people never finish their work. Work goes on expanding, becoming more and more. It is never ending. Even if a person thinks of retirement, feels that I should keep on working for a little more time. I know a gentleman, just a few years back, he was feeling, oh, so much of work. I am really, they give me so much work, they don't realize, now I am almost 65, 66, and why? How long can I be working? And while this was happening, he always, whenever we meet, he used to complain of a lot of work. Then I suggested, why don't you retire? He said, I am seriously thinking of getting retirement. I am going to retire. But he became actually so despondent, so depressed, when he actually was forced into retirement. It was a big jolt for him. And then he found himself just getting into that crazy situation, became, his mind was not stable at all. And he himself understood that it is so difficult to live without having some work that will bring some results, some rewards. Many that friends of his suggested that, well, if you are feeling bored, why don't you take up some voluntary work? But problem is there with voluntary work, that you are used to work only with the sense of some reward, and thus the idea of voluntary work does not bring any compulsion for you to do work. One gets in the habit of being pressured into work. You require pressure and then you work. It is like the slave works only when there is a stick or carrot, then only that slave is able to work. Our mentality becomes like that for working we require some pressure. Otherwise, although there are many things one can do. I said to him, you always were saying that you have a nice yard here and you don't get time to take care of it. You just get one that weekend, and in one weekend, how can you, what, in just weekend you cannot do much work. But now you have lot of time, why don't you? Well, the mind doesn't do it. It is, then one realizes what is this bondage of work. He madly kept on seeking some avenues of getting another job. Because that is, without that the craziness will not go away. It is very difficult, friends, to realize it unless one experiences. It is, otherwise one feels that, oh, okay, without work I will be so nice. I will go on vacation here, there. No, the mind keeps on attacking you. Somehow you start feeling, and that feeling is terrible, friends, that the world can go on well without you. And we don't like that feeling, that I should be needed for the world. And we have that idea. And so it becomes very difficult for a person. So this is a secret of activity that is told here, that don't get attached to these actions. And then the next part of this verse says, don't get attached to inaction. Inaction means here laziness. Don't be a lazy, indolent person. Be active. It is very important to be active, but learn to be active in the right direction. So, after having told this, it is elaborated further in the chapters 3rd, 4th, 5th. In between also has been given what is a beautiful part of Bhagavad Gita, what is called the science of a person of steady wisdom, Sthita Prajna Lakshana. And then, after telling this secret of Karma Yoga, in between you see again that emphasis comes as to one must discern between what is real and what is not real. And then from 7th chapter onwards, one gets the lesson on the devotion, turning our minds to God. It is all right to think that God is in me, but for most people, unless that gets externalized, the mind does not get fixed on it. It is all right to think that my beloved is with me. It is, somebody was telling, why should I actually worship God and bow down to some image of God? Not necessary. Can I not just think God? You told God is in us. So let me just think God is in me. Why do I need to think of God and that's enough? I told that is very good if you can keep that thought. Just see, are you? You may say that, well, my wife is in my heart. You are always in my heart, darling. You may say that. Then why you always need to go and see her? Just don't see her at all, in fact. And why you need to talk to her? Why you need to have her photograph with you? If you think that, oh, that image of God, why do you need an image of your wife? Think of that. It is all okay for you. When it comes to about God, then God is in my heart. Do you really feel God is in your heart? If you really feel that is fine. But this is a limitation of human understanding, friends. And we must be realistic. It is very important in spiritual life to be practical and realistic. It is okay if one is ready, if one is clear in that discernment, that God is the reality of the whole world. The names and forms are all illusory. And by feeling this, if they just drop from our awareness, then we don't require any external help. That is true. But we always objectify things to feel them. It is not enough just to think, even in the ordinary things, that, oh, I love ice cream and feel ice cream and just get the feeling of I am eating it. Is it enough? No, you need to go and get the actual object and stuff it in your oral cavity. Then you feel that ice cream is being eaten, not otherwise. It is why? Because that is the compulsion of our awareness, our understanding. It is limited. We are really we brag that we are intellectuals. We are not. We are emotionally driven fools. And intellect is just sometimes taken up to protect this foolishness. Instead of getting rid of that stupidity and dumbness, we use intellect to cover it, that's all. It is, if we are really intelligent, we wouldn't be caught in this dilemma in this first place. And therefore, it is very important that we see where our standing is and take up the spiritual practice according to that. If we require baby steps, we should take baby steps. Somebody else may not require that. A monkey may be able to jump to the third floor. For Yogatmananda, who has to take the staircase, if I think I will also jump, then okay, you will remain where you are. After a while, your knees will give way, that's all. It is nothing good will happen by that. Take the staircase. This is a great lesson that you see here, that devotion. A very important thing for all of us to turn our emotions to God. And that was discussed in 6 chapters from 7th onwards, called Bhakti Yoga. Turning our emotions to God, knowing that God alone is everything, all our love should be turned towards God. Turning the love, turning our emotions to the unchanging, rather than letting it flow foolishly towards the changing. And this is the exercise called Yoga of Devotion. The emotions are flowing, and because we do not have correct understanding of what is real and what is not real, the emotions are all flowing towards the unreal. What is not real is continuously passing away. To that, our emotions are actually rushing, and thus what happens to those emotions then? I love this man, this woman, this cat, this dog, and so forth. What happens to that? Well, it is a changing thing. The cat goes away, man goes away, woman goes away. And also, even if they don't go away, do we always love them? Just look at our life. A man, you may think that I love him so much at one moment. At another moment, it doesn't take too long to convert that love into an intense hatred. No, I can't live with him anymore. It becomes, and why so? Because there is nothing wrong in this person or that person as such. That fellow is so bad, treats me so bad. It is, even if that person is treating you the best, still this understanding will always be there. The play between attraction and repulsion, love and hatred, because that object itself is continuously changing. And so you cannot really love something that is not real. So direct those emotions to that which is real, the God. And it was shown in the 12th chapter that how, through integrating all these different aspects of yoga in life, That is, the broad divisions can be looked into, like the yoga of action, the yoga of emotions, that is bhakti yoga, the yoga of discernment, that is jnana yoga, and yoga of meditation, concentration and control, that is raj yoga. So all these are to be combined in one's life to lead that course in a practical way. Now the 13th chapter that we shall be taking up is about going forward with discernment. It was hinted, like all yogas were hinted earlier in the second chapter, and this also was hinted earlier. Now it is being studied in depth here. It is therefore called the Kshetra Kshetrajna Yoga. That name, Kshetra means that which is object, and Kshetrajna is the subject that knows the object. I and the world, the knower and the known. It is, we have a lot of confusion about that. And so a clear separation needs to be made between what is known and what is knower. And then get into this clarity. Once one gets into the clarity, then the life becomes illumined. So this 13th chapter is very just essential in the understanding and implementing that understanding in one's life. What is I and what is the world? What is the knower and what is the known? We have confusion in this matter a lot. And sometimes we think that, oh, what is there? I know, and this world is the known. What do you say when you say I am the knower? Is body knower or known? Confusion sets in there. Is the body, you call this body as I, is the body knower or the known? See how quickly the confusion begins. Do I see or do the eyes see? Who sees? Confusion starts there. Do I see the eyes or eyes? Do I see through the eyes? Has anybody seen the eyes? One's eyes, I mean. You can look into the eyes of others, but do you see your eyes? You don't see your eyes. So is it knower or the known? Where to begin this division? What is known and what is the knower? It is a very beautiful chapter. The analysis is very sublime, very illuminating. And as we proceed in this chapter, we will see the difference between what we call knowledge of this world and the knowledge of the self. It is what is called as the that knowledge of the science, physical science, and the knowledge of this spiritual wisdom, what is it? Is what is the difference between their methodologies, difference between their results, and this needs to be therefore understood clearly. No knowledge is really here criticized. There is nothing of that kind said here that the knowledge of science is bad. In fact, it is told that that knowledge is also to be acquired. We will see as we proceed. Some editions of Bhagavad Gita have an extra verse here that comes as a question of Arjuna. But the edition that I am referring to and the editions that I mostly studied does not contain that first verse ascribed to Arjuna as a question. But that is Arjuna's request in that question, to give that understanding. But even if that question is not exclusively or explicitly asked, we can refer it as the matter that they answer. It is the answer that will tell us what the question was. It could be done reverse way, that a funny thing had happened, that from the treatment that was given to the patient, the diagnosis could be understood, you know, that the doctor had written on the paper some diagnosis, but then water fell on that paper and that line was kind of not readable. So when he went to some other physician, the physician wanted to know what that diagnosis was, and he could not read that line. But then by reading the medications and all, he got to it. Okay, so since the medication is for this, disease must be this and this. So, similarly, we can infer here the question was about the understanding of what is changing, what is unchanging, what is the knower, what is the known. The Lord begins the answer like this. All one can just take it up as there is no question explicitly asked at all, but this confusion needs to be clarified, and so Lord begins this sermon directly. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, the Blessed Lord said, Idam Shariram Kaunteya Kshetramityabhidhiyate Etad Yo Vetitam Praho Kshetrajna Iti Tadvidah. This body, O son of Kunti, is called the Kshetra, and that which is conscious of it is called Kshetrajna, the embodied self, by those who have knowledge thereof. So this of course begs lot of explanation. Today's time, as you can see, is over, and so we shall take up that discussion and next Friday. Any questions? Yes, Charles?
You said at the beginning tonight that Arjuna originally wanted revenge against the evil titans. I thought it was mostly Bhima who wanted revenge, and the other Pandavas were just fighting out of a sense of duty without any real hatred towards their titans.
It is, and Bhima expressed it more vociferously. But not that Arjuna had no such idea. There are some sentences given in Mahabharata that show that even Arjuna had that idea.
And Yudhishthira really didn't have those ideas.
Huh?
Yudhishthira did not.
Yudhishthira didn't have the idea of revenge, that is true. But Yudhishthira was very special in his establishment of various virtues in life, and was had much clearer perception than others. So, but Arjuna did have the idea of revenge, yes. Yes, John?
Ironic, you're starting the 13th chapter on Friday.
Right, okay. Thank you for reminding me. That yes, 13th chapter has been started on Friday, the 13th of January. Okay. Oh, you have another question?
Well, that was a statement, yeah.
Okay.
It seems to me like you talk about the God within everyone. And I'm thinking that people have this idea of what is fair, you know, when you're in, I'm thinking about the kids on the school bus now, you know, they all, my turn, and then somebody else has their turn, then my turn, but there's always some justification that comes in to say,
yeah,
well, I should, even though it's not my turn, I should have that, like, it's the favorite.
Yeah, that is true. As a kid, I also remember having gone through this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I also used to go on a school bus, and then we used to have that kind of fight amongst each other and also with the driver that why I should have this favored seat and so forth. That, and we always would have some justification for our claim, and it continues in the, as one grows up, the issues become different, not the school bus seat, but not very different from that either, you know. It is just those little things of life which create lot of quarrels, lot of differences. I told you that one person, one gentleman, professor and all that, but says, well, I have, you know, sometimes we have quarrels with my wife, and sometimes I feel that she is just impossible. I said, well, what is that you have quarrels about? And then he said smilingly, Swami, really nothing much, you know. Why did she give me a smaller piece of pie and took a bigger one for herself? And such foolish things, that nothing much, but it is like that. Because of that whatever I want, I try to import a justification for it. If I want to go for war, somehow or other, I will collect the reason to go for the war. That is how the human beings, they do not really have an impartial view. Our sense of justice really is sense of justice only if we learn detachment. If sense of justice is really correct sense of justice, if I know there is nothing I and mine, then only one can have this a potent idea of justice. Otherwise, my I and mine, that will start disturbing the balance. What is fair and unfair? Well, if something that puts me in a beneficial spot, then that is, I will try to show that it is fair. Otherwise, it is unfair. It is so unfair. It is one young professor girl was telling me that she has been given something that she didn't want to teach. It is so unfair. Point of view of other people, it would be very fair. It is, some would say this is fair, others would say this is not fair. Well, how would you judge that? How would you make those laws? And it is the idea of justice also therefore requires that detachment. No, that there is nothing yours in this world, then you can have that sense of what is fair and what is unfair. Otherwise, it will always be skewed up. It will be always in my favor or your favor and so forth. So let us conclude. If you want, you know, there was a lecture, John. A few years back, we had a talk given by Swami Ishtananda, who is right now in Florida, head of our Vedanta Center there. He had come here to give a retreat and gave a talk on detachment. And there he brought this point of justice.
It's not fair
that you never got to Florida. Okay.
Huh?
Okay. And did you go to even all parts of Rhode Island? You didn't go to all parts of Rhode Island or even maybe all parts of Providence. Is it fair? गीतास्तु गीता कर्तव्या किमन्यत् शास्त्रविस्तरैः या स्वयं पद्मनाभस्य मुखपद्माद्विनिसृता एकं शास्त्रं देवकी पुत्रगीतम् एको देवो देवकी पुत्र एव एको मन्त्रः तस्य नामानि यानि कर्माप्येकं तस्य देवस्य सेवा श्रीकृष्णार्पणमस्तु. An announcement, friends, coming Sunday. It's a very awesome